Talk is Quantitative Mineralogy Using Radiative Transfer Modeling by Lucy Cahill, Reiner, and Cahill. And the part of Paul Lucy will be played by Josh Cahill.
Hello, I'm Paul Lucy. Is this the... Yeah. So, okay. So we're going to go down. All right, so here's the big challenge. Taking visible near-infrared hyperspectral data in whatever form, whether it's laboratory or telescopic or the new data we'll be getting back from Chandrayaan, and putting it into a geochemical mineralogical context with the samples we already have. Now, our basic approach is using a mixing model that takes into account relative compositional parameters of minerals and fit an unknown spectrum by adjusting the compositional parameters of those minerals in terms of iron and Mg number and so on and so forth. This approach has worked very well in the context of Mars for TESS. However, we have a different dynamic with the Moon. The plausibility for the Moon, we have a little bit less restricted range of variables, or more restricted. We have a little bit less minerals to actually consider. We have a fairly simple system in terms of plagioclase, pyroxene, olivine, ilmenite. Glutenates are also very important. And other minerals are likely important in other isolated locations, but these are the main ones we're concerned with at this point. So mixing modeling issues in terms of the Moon. First, in terms of visible near-infrared spectra, we can't use a linear mixing model like we can for thermal infrared data for tests and so forth. So what we institute is a Hapi-based model where we actually take into account the optical constants of minerals and we are able to calculate a single scattering albedo from that, which we can compute reflectance data from. So other problems we have to deal with are space weathering, optical effects. Hapi has a pretty good model for the effect of nanophase iron in lunar soils, and we also take into account glutenates as a dark neutral parameter, kind of similar to ilmenite. And a fixed set of variables for your mixing model isn't necessarily what we're going for. We have a fixed number of variables in terms of minerals, but we vary their composition as a function of Mg number. And we ignore the compositionally dependent properties of plagioclase in this model, for instance, AN content. Grain sizes is also another concern, but as Peters has shown and Lucy has also reconfirmed recently, the most optically dominant grain size range in terms of the Moon is this 10 to 20 micron size fraction. And so we really are able to model this by setting a grain size that's pretty much constant somewhere in the middle of that range. And Lucy confirmed that when he let grain size just vary by trying to match iron, it settled right around at 16 to 17 microns in grain size as the most optically dominant grain size to be concerned with. So here's our basic methodology in taking a look at lunar soils and telescopic data that I'm actually going to be presenting here. We basically, in order to make sure that we're finding a unique answer, we actually start at 56 places all across the ternary. I'm going to show you a diagram of that in just a moment. And we model each Mg number, iteratively changing the composition until there are 56 composition right here that we started with, 56 right here, and we iteratively change that composition until we find which Mg number model is the best. So this is an ideal solution where we can pick out our good, our bad, and our extremely ugly versions. And we can pick the mineralogy and the Mg number and the composition from that. Now this is an ideal version. What we actually are seeing in practice is something that looks a little bit more like this. The majority of the soils we've actually looked at, about two-thirds to three-quarters of them are similar to this, where there's an obvious winner, an obvious choice. that's working the best in terms of goodness of fit. However, sometimes we have, once we get close to MG number of 50 and below, we start seeing little problems here where there's some ambiguity. And as you can see here, also there's a less unique answer. So as I said before, we start with 56 different compositions spread all around the ternary, and we let them iteratively change, trying to model that single spectrum until they find somewhat of a unique answer. So for example, this is probably a pretty good example of what we see here, whereas something like this, where there's more, there's less certainty, we would see more of a cloud around the composition we're actually looking for. So in terms of the actual results we're seeing, for the four main minerals we're concerned with right now, olivine, OPX, clinopyroxene, and plagioclase, we see relatively good results, although we'd like to see better. In terms of plagioclase, the worst case scenario we're seeing is probably about 20 volume percent accuracy. However, if you take the mean absolute difference between the soils and what we're actually seeing with modeling, you get more of an accuracy between 6 and 9 volume percent for any of the minerals you're looking at. So olivine is in green, OPX is in the white diamonds, CPX is in the red stars here. Now, when we started this project, I've been pressing Paul for a little while. Let's move the MG number further down, like I was showing you right there. And as you noticed, as we went further down and try and model MG numbers below 50, we started to run into a lot more problems. Always before, when I tried to press him to do this, no, can't do that. You can't do that. We don't have the optical constants for it, but we can interpolate it, Paul. We can interpolate it. Well, this is what happened when we took a look at the actual MG number combination. Of course, above MG numbers of 50, we're seeing a lot better accuracy, but below, for these are a lot of the Mare soils, we're getting inaccurate results. But Paul took a look at it and said, "Well, I told you so." And but we also took a look at it and it's like, "Well, yeah, you know, there's a little bit of a correlation there." So this is the uncorrected version, and this is the corrected. And basically, what I'm looking at here is this is the fuse bead MG number that was calculated from the fuse beads of the soils versus the model. And, you know, I got a little interested in this. So like, you know, there might be something else to this. So I also took advantage of the modal mineralogy that the Lunar's LSCC took and the average MG numbers they have for that. And, you know, first I added the most, the ones we were concerned with MG number first and foremost, the worst pyroxene and olivine. We get a better correlation, and then I started adding glass or plagioclase. I got a little bit better of a correlation, and then I added the glass and get even a better correlation. We correct that to get something like that, and then I add ilmenite, and everything goes back to the fuse bead. So there seems to be a little disconnect there that we're not taking into account everything we should be. But above MG numbers of 50, we're doing fairly well. But we definitely need better optical constants, or optical constants in general, below MG numbers of 50. So that's where the model is at this point. So we decided to apply what we had learned to the moon. Of course, in the context of the moon, we're taking a look at north sites, which are thought to be the original remnants of the North Sitic crust. We have the MG Suite rocks. That are more plutonic and more mafic in general. And we've taken a look at trying to place these results in the context of the lunar rocks we've been getting back. So one of the most famous diagrams we've seen in terms of lunar geology is just being able to separate Farran and Orthosites and MG Suite rocks. And this is probably one of the most famous just simply because it can be done so easily with a microprobe that's non-destructive and so on and so forth, with just MG number of olivine versus the AN content of plagioclase. Now, I told you before, we can't do this in spectral reflectance. However, what we can do with some relative certainty is actual plagioclase abundance. So we took a look at the lunar, about, this is approximately 100 samples with the weighted Mg number of the mafic minerals and the mean plagioclase that they had. And it effectively did somewhat similar thing, same thing. Now, Brad's been saying, well, you know, there are little things you need to think about. You're absolutely right. Evidently, there's a Faroan mafic rock or two that we haven't, I hadn't even known about. But on a large scale, it's probably those seem to be a little bit anomalous. But of course, with this diagram, we also can't differentiate alkali suite north sites. But this was kind of big for us because, you know, we can at least start trying to put it into a context of the lunar rocks. So applying this to Aristarchus Plateau, which is really a diverse and dynamic area. It's a Copernican age crater, Aristarchus right here, extremely geologically diverse. It's got probably the highest thorium on the moon and actually two thorium anomalies from the most recent studies by Lawrence. It's got unusually clinopyroxene-rich highland rocks thought to be gabbro-gabbronorite type pathologies and some olivine-rich deposits around the east and southern or eastern southern rims of the crater. So here are the telescopic spectra we're going to apply the model to. These were collected by Beery Hawk and Tompkins and Carly Peters. And Beery tells me that Carly really was a stickler for trying to get good data of these telescopic spectra. And he said she was pretty tenacious in going about it. So each telescopic spectra shown here, most of which were reported in Lucy's paper in 1986. I think that was his dissertation paper. And each one represents about a 2 kilometer ground resolution, and they vary from 700 to 250 nanometers. Now, placing these spectra, after having modeled them, placing them into the rock type classification scheme that we've seen for lunar rocks, we see an ultramafic deposit, or perhaps not ultramafic, but much more mafic than the rest of the deposits. This is actually confirming some of the clementine spectra we've seen for some of the olivine deposits that Lemulik differentiated in one of his recent papers. But the majority of them are looking more gabbro-gabbronorite with Mg numbers similar to the rock, lunar rocks we already have, the Mg suite rocks. But we also are seeing Faron and Northsite deposits right here. One of these is actually the central peak, which is interesting and reconfirms what they saw on clementine, but the central peak in the clementine data was actually saturated, so the data wasn't as easy to actually examine. So we can also put this into a more mineralogic context with the lunar sample mineralogies on the ternary. And here's how they plot up for Aristarchus, the modeling of Aristarchus, where we're seeing, again, dominantly olivine-bearing gabbronorite. And here's that one really ultramafic deposit that was on part of the rim of the crater. And Paul wanted to point out that they're relatively orthopyroxene depleted, although I think I've depleted more below 10%. But in conclusion, our mixing model is beginning to perform sufficiently well to produce usable mineral and chemical analysis for hyperspectral data in preparation for Chandrayaan, and even taking a look at some of the data we have from telescopic studies taken in the mid-80s. Comparison with the lunar soils shows at least a 20% accuracy. Paul just eyeballed it and put up 20% accuracy, but when you actually go through and do the statistics, it's closer to a 6 to 9 mean absolute difference between what they're seeing for the LSCC soils and what we're getting for the model. We definitely need refinement of pyroxene optical constants. We just don't have them below 50, Mg number of 50. And also something I didn't mention, it might have an influence on the Mg number modeling that we're doing, is we're assuming that these all the mafic minerals are in equilibrium, so they don't have different Mg numbers. That may definitely have an influence on what we're looking at in terms of modeling the Mg number for all the mafic minerals. And applied to Aristarchus, our modeling seems to confirm previous suggestions the exposures of MG suite gabbronorites on and around Aristarchus crater and the plateau, but the compositions are not identical to any of the known gabbronorites that we have. And so I'll take any questions now. Thanks for letting me impersonate Paul for a little while.
Good time for a question or two. Randy, I haven't heard from you yet.
Okay.
The volcanic meteorites don't contain those magic magnesium sweet rocks. They may contain gabbronorites.
Okay.
Question for Paul first.
Get into my Paul.
When you run
Oh, yeah, we set the MG number to the same value for all of the mafic minerals. I see what you're saying, and even in equilibrium conditions, there's some variation, but we just make them all the same at this point. Brett actually let them vary between the mafic minerals in one of our recent papers, actually looking into the linear soils, and it's all right, but once you do that, the time constraints become difficult because that creates a spectral library and an iterative process that can take a lot longer, so processing power becomes critical in order to actually do that. But we've definitely thought about doing it, but doing it in a way that can be done in a reasonable amount of time is another task entirely. Yeah.
Now, overnight's going to have quite a profound effect on your MG number, depending upon the amount that you're going to get hold of. So, any ideas as to why overnight?
Well, we're really having, you know, we have some difficulty modeling ilmenite at this point. I mean, ilmenite is a different beast entirely in terms of the visible near infrared, as Miriam and a lot of the others who specialize in taking a look at ilmenite will tell you. Getting around and actually modeling ilmenite effectively is something we've obviously not been doing at this point. We've been concentrating on the main silicates. So you're absolutely right. It's something that we have to take a closer look at and find out how to wrangle.
What exactly would you need? You know exactly what you would need in order to be able to do that in terms of the data that Miriam was showing, Brad was showing earlier on.
Need in terms of actually modeling it?
Right.
That is the question in general, and I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth. We've spoken to Paul about getting optical constants for ilmenite, and he'll answer, we'll come back, it's like, no, those won't help. we haven't had much more of a discussion beyond that at this point, but... It is a possibility. It definitely is a possibility. I there's definitely a thorium anomaly there. I just haven't instituted it into our study at this point. So
we've done mixing models of the thorium and iron and suggested that could be alkali and orthosite, and that the gabbro component could be an alkali gabbro or monzo gabbro component.
Oh, really?
All right, I think we'll let Paul off the hook.
All right.
Thanks again.
Thanks. All right, so we now have our last talk of the day.